Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to Spiritual Renewal Week, Inner Renewal Week.
It's so wonderful to see so many of you here, both from the community and from visiting from our other community. So it's one beautiful family in God. And The purpose of this week, which we started some years ago, was just to, here we are in the middle of a gray, cold winter season, and you're kind of, your meditations, oh, I have to get up, it's cold and it's dark. And we thought, let's infuse ourselves with enthusiasm, inspiration, and Master's presence. Thank you, David, for your tape, it's beautiful. And so this is why we do it. It isn't that any of the presenters are maybe no any more than any of you, but when we come together, we bring God's presence, and that's why we do this. So let's all try very hard this week to live in the remembrance of God. Everything else can go. Nothing else is important, but living in the remembrance of God is really the reason we took birth. So
this week has a slightly different focus from Spiritual Renewal Week. In the Gita, Krishna says, out of 1,000, only one seeks me. And out of 1,000 who seek, only one finds me. Well, Master said, our percentages are much better. But nonetheless, this is aimed, this week especially. It started out basically as a week of seclusion or group pilgrimage, group retreat for the community. And then we realized that our community is much bigger than just those who reside on this property. But it's meant for those people who have already decided that they want God and are dedicating this life to finding Him. So let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Friend, beloved God,
Great Masters,
Jesus Christ,
Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya,
Swami Sri
Yukteswar,
beloved Guru,
Paramahansa Yoganandaji,
saints of all religions,
we humbly bow to you all.
Beloved Lord,
awaken in us
the deep desire
to merge with thee,
and the deep determination
to do what is needed
in order to find thee.
We are thine.
Be thou ours.
Om. Peace. Amen.
Seeking this none could share.
We have a traditional way of starting these weeks, which many of you have experienced already and enjoy. And it's in remembrance of, in the Bhagavad Gita, as the two forces gathered, the forces of light, the forces of darkness, the spiritual forces, the material forces, it starts out basically naming the warriors, and then the Pandavas blow their conches. The Pandavas represent the five chakras, and Krishna represents the chakra, the spiritual eye. And the fact that they're blowing their conches means that allegorically that that's the sound of Om as it expresses. Each one of the Pandavas represents a different chakra. And so it's the sound of Om as it expresses itself in that chakra. And so, in remembrance of that, we begin the inner renewal week with the blowing of a conch. We won't say which chakra this represents. Let's assume that it's Master's and Krishna's. As Master would do, how feels everyone?
Awake and ready.
And how is everyone?
Awake and ready.
Okay, now he would say we can begin. So, this week's classes are on the three pillars of this spiritual path. And those three pillars are what we'll discuss today, which is sadhana. Tomorrow we'll discuss meditation. Meditation is part of the sadhana that we'll discuss today. And on tomorrow, seva. And for those of you who have heard, I'm in the process of writing a book on seva. I'll describe that in much more detail tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we'll discuss attunement with the guru. And those are the three pillars of our path: sadhana, seva, and attunement. And so this morning we'll discuss sadhana. So I want to just get my notes here so I don't forget anything. The Swami, many years ago, said to the people living here at the community, Ananda Village, but he meant it for all of those who had really dedicated their lives to the spiritual search. He said that the goal in this life should be to become a Jivan Mukta. Now, Jivan Mukta is a very, very high goal to set. You know, I don't know how many people have climbed Mount Everest now. I suspect it's in the thousands. Many years ago, Binay and Haridas and Jaya and I climbed Mount Shasta. And it was a big struggle. It's not easy. It's 15,000 feet, and got up to the top. And I thought, whoa, we have really succeeded in something hard. And you could sign a book there showing that you had made the summit. Unfortunately, the book was about that thick with others who had also made the summit. And that was only for the month that we had been climbing. So I realized it maybe wasn't as great of an accomplishment as I thought. But for those who have climbed Mount Everest, the book is really quite thin. Or for the Olympic athletes who've won a gold medal, it's really quite thin. Well, both of those groups far, far outnumber the number of people who will become Jivan Muktas in this life. So Swami was setting a very high goal for us. But if we don't shoot for that high goal, then we're destined and perhaps happy to wander among the valleys and the little hillocks and think that we've accomplished something. And so for each of us, we need to also think about what our personal goal in this life is. Maybe it isn't to become a Jivan Mukta. Maybe that seems to be too high of a... I'm starting a timer here so I don't over-talk and... let us say, suffer the consequences. So, there is, for each of us, we have to figure out kind of what our goal is, what realistically, because it has to come from your own heart. We'll talk during the week about this theme in several different areas. But whatever we do in the spiritual search has to be a transmutation of the energies that we have within. Master said that the great block, the great enemy, is desire. And desire is awakened by restlessness or the rajasic aguna. So that restlessness creates, just as a wind creates waves on the ocean or waves on a pond, that restlessness creates waves of desires. And so that's the enemy. So we're trying to overcome those desires. But think of the waves on the ocean. You can't expect to go out to the ocean and suppress every one of the waves on the Pacific. And you might think that that's an exaggeration of the restlessness in our mind, but it's actually a much less degree. So you can't suppress all of those waves by pushing down and hoping that they're going to stay calm. And so what has to happen, Master said, is that you have to stop that causative factor, which is creating the waves, that causative factor on the ocean is the wind. The causative factor in our consciousness is, one might say, the breath, which represents the wind. But more importantly, it's the outgoing energy that goes out of us, streams out of us like a wind, and creates those waves. And so the whole of these three pillars is basically to turn that energy back inside. And I'm going to read a passage later on from Masters talking about this directly. But the goal of our three pillars of the spiritual path is to reverse that outgoing flow. And when it reverses, and when especially it comes up into a state of stillness or a state of single focus on achieving union with God, then the wind has stopped, and you don't need to suppress those waves because they die down and stop in and of themselves. And so part of that process is that we have to work in a way where we're not only willing, but joyfully willing to transmute these desires. Because if we're inwardly conflicted, then it's one step forward, two steps forward, and one step back. And we make slow progress, but nonetheless, the progress is relatively slow. So our job, in part, as devotees, is to get joyfully and willingly behind the desire to have our union with God or self-realization. If we're yogis, then what we're seeking is yoga, union with God, union of the soul with God, union of the body and mind with the soul, until we find the actual experience, not just the mental aspect, but the actual experience of feeling the consciousness expand and feeling the unity with everything. There's a beautiful book that is about the early years of Ananda Moy Ma's life. And she was a great, great, great saint. And from the time that she was a little girl, she would, for instance, 6 or 7 years old, if she heard a kirtan going on, or even the playing of a gong, the consciousness would leave her physical body and she would slump down on the floor and go into a very elevated state of samadhi. And she said, in that state, there is no possibility of duality. There's no possibility of there being another. It simply is all one. And so when we get to that state, there will be no possibility of not being merged with God, because in that state, we realize that all that exists is God, and we have always been just an aspect, just a projection, part of the dream, God's one dream. So just as at night, every character in your dream is an extension of your own consciousness, we're in God's dream, and we're all extensions of His own consciousness. But in your dream, those characters don't realize that they're extensions of your consciousness. Nor in our current state, because we're still attached to the body consciousness and the outgoing energy, we don't yet have the full knowledge, although we're well on the way, but we don't have the full realization, one might say, that we don't exist except as a part of God's dream. So I want to kind of set the stage for this week by telling a story which a number of you have heard, but I'm going to tell it in a deeper, more more pervasive sense than I have before. Some years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, Devi and I were in India with Swamiji in sitting at the breakfast table. And as I said, he had told us that there was that the general goal that we should be striving for was to become Jivan Muktas. And we were just talking with him about that's an awfully high goal. It's not easy. We feel a little inadequate in trying to achieve that goal. So, yeah, face it, we were whining a little bit about the challenges of the spiritual path. And he summed up the whole of the spiritual path in this way. He was eating breakfast. He had taken a scoop of, I don't know what it was, I think it was an egg, I'm not sure, on his fork, and he was about to eat it, and he paused midway, and he said, the whole of the spiritual path is to overcome the delusion of the ego. That is done by longer, deeper meditation, and by seeing God as the doer in everything, and then finished his bite. Now, he might have added in that the third part, because he often said the most important thing on the spiritual path is attunement with the guru. So he might have added, the whole of the spiritual path is overcoming the ego. That is done through longer, deeper meditation, by seeing God as the doer in everything, and by attunement with the guru, and finish the bite. And that's the marching orders for our life. So that's the summation. Now the ego, because it helps to understand clearly some of these concepts. The ego is not a thing. It's not like a being. It is a state of delusion. We might liken it to the ego is you at night when you're dreaming and having a dream. And in that dream, you project onto your characters some qualities. So I was having a dream last night. For some reason, I was with some members of my family, and we were going through a whole kind of a drama going on, not a negative one, just, you know, dreamlike miasma. But I was projecting onto myself in that dream a series of qualities. I looked more or less like I look. You know, I was my age, I was having, I was in a male body, I was, you know, all of these things. So Swami said the ego is the bundle of self-definitions that we project on ourself. Master said it is a soul attached to the delusion that it is the body and the personality. And so both of those ways of describing it, it's helpful to understand that the ego isn't something different from ourselves that we can get rid of by somehow putting it in jail. Or Master used, I love this image that Master used. He said, you can't get rid of the ego as if it's something that you can blow up with TNT. Because it's consciousness. In fact, everything is consciousness. And so the ego is just a kind of a aspect of our consciousness in which we think that we're confined and defined by these few little things that separate us from the whole. And so if you think that you're a man, then you can't be everybody in creation that's a woman. You've separated yourself, or vice versa. And if you think that you're an American, you've shut out all the other countries. And If you think that you're, I don't know, a banker, you've shut out. So you see, every time you have a self-definition, what you do is you take your vast potential, because in fact you are everything and everyone in higher consciousness. In God's consciousness, he's everything. And so the ego simply shuts out all of those possibilities and shrinks it down and shrinks it down and shrinks it down and shrinks it down until you become this, and then you also become proud of it. I saw a cartoon, I think it was in the New Yorker, and this man and woman were in a yard and they were looking up and there were thousands of stars, and the woman had obviously said something because the man was responding. He said, "Make me feel small? No, it doesn't make me feel small. I was just advanced to branch manager after all." And so the ego just shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and then not only do we get the promotion to branch manager, but then our whole focus becomes on that. And we forget in that miasma that we're the soul, that we're an aspect of God, and we can go on and on and on, many, many, really billions of lifetimes, taking up a different bundle of self-definition and becoming engrossed in them. And so what we're trying to do is dissolve that ego. That's what Swami said. The whole of the spiritual path is overcoming the delusion of the ego. And so in the attempt to dissolve that ego, then the next question is, all right, how do I do that? That's the beginning of Patanjali, you know. He said that, and Master made a big point of this, that the beginning of Patanjali says, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga. Science of yoga is how to achieve, how to dissolve the ego, how to do it. But that "and now" means that there's a whole vast period of time before you're ready to ask, how do I get over this ego? Because you're busy being the branch manager. And so that desire to overcome the ego is God-given, and it is the soul's desire. You know, the soul knows its communion with God, knows its unity with God. And yet that dreaming state, gradually, as Master said, we become over and over and over experiencing, you know, whatever bundle of self-definitions and whatever driven, obsessive, compulsive disorders that brings about for that lifetime. We experience that again and again, enough times, so that Master said, there comes an agonizing sense of monotony. The soul said, "Ah, oh, not this again, not diapers again. High school? Have to do high school all over?" I have a recurring nightmare that... Yeah, a lot of hands went up. Me too, me too. I missed some test. And therefore, not only did I not graduate from high school, but college didn't count. And so I had to go back and anyway. So the soul gets this anguishing sense of monotony. And so we don't really need to worry about the deep motivation. God has taken care of that. Because we all come from God, it is inevitable that the deepest of our desires is to return to that state, because that state is absolutely blissful, and it's eternal, and it answers all of the problems of the fears and anxieties and restlessness of a lifetime confined in the ego. And so that soul desire will drive us on. So the desire to achieve that, then Swami said, how do we achieve that? By longer and deeper meditation. Well, longer is easier to figure out. I'll talk about that secondly. But what does deeper meditation mean? I'm going to read a passage. By the way, I'm skipping ahead to Wednesday's class. One of the very best ways to stay attuned is to take a book of masters, and this is a watershed book. The passages in here, when Swami was with, this is the essence of self-realization, the book. We have a lot of people watching online. The essence of self-realization, when Swami was with Master said something, and then he said to Swami, write that down. I've never said that before. And so Swami began writing down the things that Master said, and he collected those, and he had hundreds of little slips of paper and cards. And then finally, he felt the time was right to collect those together and put them into a book. And this is the book that resulted. So this is a fairly long, these are all little sayings, but Swami also collected several together that were all on the same theme. So this is fairly long, so I want you to close your eyes and you have the glasses just in case it'd be easier to read. And I'm going to read this because it's a summation of what we mean by deeper. My guru, Sri Yukteswar, liked a chant that I have translated, two lines from which go, pranayama be thy religion, pranayama will give thee salvation. Pranayama means control of the energy in the body and its direction upward through the spine to the brain and to the Christ center between the eyebrows. This alone is the pathway of awakening. It isn't a matter of dogma or belief. It is simply the way we are all made by God. The consciousness enters the body by way of the brain and the spine. When the sperm and ovum unite to create a physical body, they do so at what becomes the medulla oblongata, at the base of the brain. From this medulla, the life force moves out into the brain, down the spine, and into the nervous system, then onto the muscles, etc., creating the body. The way out of the body, then, is to reverse this process. The difficulty in doing so lies in the fact that the life force is already conditioned by birth to continue its outward direction, through the senses and onward to the environment, as it is perceived through the senses. Thus, we think to possess the world and to enjoy it through the body. We can never experience anything outside ourselves, however, except vicariously, as the senses report their impressions to the brain. We may try to expand our understanding of the world by study or our enjoyment of it through sense pleasures. The fact remains, we can never know anything except through the medium of the senses so long as the life force remains trapped in the body. There is a way out, however, for it is the life force to merge with the cosmic energy, for the consciousness to merge in the infinite consciousness. The way to accomplish this end is to withdraw the life force from the senses and center it in the spine, to direct it upward through the spine to the brain and thence out through the Christ center between the eyebrows. The ego is centered in the medulla oblongata. This is the negative pole of self-consciousness. The positive pole is situated at the Christ center. Concentration at this center, in the spiritual eye, the seat of spiritual vision, projects the consciousness beyond the ego into infinity. The spine is the highway to the infinite. Your own body is the temple of God. It is within your own self that God must be realized. Whatever places of pilgrimage you wish to visit outwardly, and whatever outward rituals you perform, the ultimate pilgrimage must be within, and the ultimate religious rite must be the offering of your life force on the altar of inner communion, of inner God communion. That is why Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." He spake, the Bible adds, of the temple of his body. This is the path of Kriya Yoga. And so, when we talk about deeper, this explains what deeper is. So in meditation, in deep meditation, the whole goal of deep meditation is to withdraw the prana, withdraw the energy, and to bring that energy up the spine, past the medulla, passing it through the medulla, which is the center of ego, and bring it to the spiritual eye. And so that process of withdrawal of energy and the upward direction of it, one could say that is our whole spiritual path for those of us who have now come to the study of the science of yoga. Because that is, simply put, the way out and the only way out. Now, does that mean that no other religion or no other way will get a person there? No, it doesn't. But they have to go through in their own way that same process. And maybe it's by such increasingly deep and deep devotion that they become self-forgetful. And the energy in deep devotion goes up and does that same thing. But whatever the means are, the process has to be the same, the withdrawal of energy and the bringing of the energy up and to the spiritual eye and ultimately out past the spiritual eye. And so when we talk about deep meditation, that's what we mean by deep meditation. The more purely that process, the more powerfully that process happens, the more we're able to indraw the life force, the more purely we're able to bring that energy up to the spiritual eye. That's what deep meditation is. All meditation, no matter what the path, the kind, whatever, all meditation is meant to accomplish this process. And when we accomplish it, the mind becomes still. The thinking process begins to first quiet down like restless waves on the sea. First the wind begins to die down. Then Master said, spontaneously certain places in the sea have no waves in them. They're just quiet. In deep meditation, spontaneously, your mind will have certain places, certain periods, where it's just quiet. I'm sure that you've all experienced that. Now, Kriya Yoga is the supreme technique for achieving that, because as Master said in the autobiography, quoting his Sanskrit teacher, Kabalananda, that Kriya Yoga is the fastest, the most powerful technique ever given to mankind for God realization, or we might say this, for achieving this process of withdrawal of energy and bringing it up to and through the spiritual eye, the most powerful technique ever given to man for spiritual advancement by self-effort. And so our self-effort ought to be directed toward, always directed toward the withdrawal of that energy. Master said to Swamiji, he said, when others get involved in outward activities, you should go and do a few kriyas. When others are busy talking, withdraw, go and do a few kriyas. So what he was saying to him is that the life of a deep devotee is constantly focused around withdrawing the energy from its outward direction to an inward direction and lifting it up. Now, tomorrow we'll talk about how service done properly achieves that. And on Wednesday, how attunement with the guru done properly achieves that. But coming back to getting it really clear what deeper meditation means, it's to have that process done ever more completely and ever more deeply. Now, if you're like me, you kind of think, oh, how am I ever going to achieve complete stillness of the mind? It just doesn't seem possible. Master said, it isn't, see, the restless mind doesn't think it can ever get unrestless. The area on the sea that's being lashed by the wind doesn't think the waves will ever die down. But spontaneously, as long as we're trying to stop that wind or calm that wind or block that wind, spontaneously areas grow up where it's already calm. So spontaneously in meditation, you will find periods that are calm and completely focused. And in that calm and completely focused is the essence of deeper. So Patanjali talked about these three. So pranayama, the withdrawal of the energy, leads to pratyahara, which is the shutting down of the disruption of the senses. Master called it the shutting off of the sense telephones. But remember that energy goes out through the senses, so now it's withdrawn. Then we go in to what Patanjali called samyama. This is true meditation. When the energy is completely withdrawn, there are three, one might say, stages or the spectrum. First is dharana, which is complete concentration. I'm sure that I have experienced periods of dharana in meditation where you're completely focused. Let's say you're after kriya, during kriya, you're completely focused on drawing the energy up and down the spine, and that's your mind isn't restless. It's completely focused. If it's completely focused, you have achieved the state of dharana. If you can hold that, then the mind becomes absorbed in that. Let's say now after meditation, after kriya, we're looking into the light at the spiritual eye. Maybe the mind is restless, and then it's calm, restless, then it's calm. But if you can hold that focus, and then the focus becomes absorbing to your mind so that you aren't thinking about I'm looking into the light. You simply feel like you are the light. That's the state of dhyana. And then if you can hold that, you go out of the body into Christ consciousness, into becoming light, and that's the state of samadhi. So these three together, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Now, setting for a moment aside samadhi, Master said that our goal should be to try to achieve stillness, the point of dharana and dhyana, the deep concentration. And he said, and he gave us an achievable goal in this. He said, if you can do that for 1 hour, that's enough. Because if you can do that focus for an hour, then that will lead you into the expansion of the consciousness through the spiritual eye and into Christ consciousness. So that seems more achievable than not, you know, having this vague sense that deeper is a never-ending process that will never get there. So, but coming back, whether it's a second, a minute, or an hour, where we're trying to achieve that complete stillness, deeper means to achieve more and more stillness of mind. As we do so, everything spontaneously proceeds from that point. And so when we sit to meditate, our goal, conscious goal, remember I said that we have to do these things because it's the transmutation of the ego, the bundles of self-definition. We have to joyfully and willingly want that process to proceed. So when we sit to meditate, the first act of real depth is to convince the mind that you joyfully and willingly want to go deep and want to merge with God. Now, we can all do that. That's relatively simple. I'm sure everybody in this room, every sincere person, is able to achieve that goal of convincing yourself that in this meditation, I really do want to go deep. I really do want to merge with God. Isn't that achievable for all of us? So that's the starting point. Then once we start there, we have to just continue trying to go deeper and deeper in that process. So the process isn't hard to understand. It's really quite simple to understand. The doing of it, because the restlessness of the mind, the habitual outward flowing prana, karmic aspects, all of those pull the energy away from that. There are obstacles, and so the doing of it is a little bit difficult, but it isn't hard to understand. Okay, coming on to longer meditations. What does that mean? It means to meditate longer than you are now. And I'm not going to give a number. Whatever you're doing, longer means longer. You know, the master quotes the great saint in the autobiography who meditated 16 hours a day saying, I've done nothing, basically. So anyway, but we're not born into a life where it's easy just to withdraw. The master had a different reason for drawing us. And so whatever you're doing now, try to do it a little bit longer. The way to do that is by doing it gradually, meaning that try to increase every periodically, try to increase just a little bit. So 5% or 1% or 10% longer. The second way to do it is once a week have a long meditation that is 2 or 3 times longer than your typical meditation. And the third way of doing that is by having a seclusion period each year that allows you to be completely focused on going into longer and deeper meditations. So I'm going to end with 2 things. First of all, sadhana is much more than just meditation alone. It's everything that we do throughout the day that tends to withdraw the energy and bring it up. It can be the remembrance of God. It can be pure service. It can be lots and lots of different things. But it is the withdrawal of energy from being outward directed and engaging us in the world, the false world of the senses. Anything we do to withdraw that energy is part of our sadhana. The second thing that I want to say is that there is going to be a kind of an experiment this Inner Renewal Week, which is we're all going to be participants in helping to create a list of the top tips of things that work for us. Many of us are teachers. Many of us, all of us, are practitioners. And so we want to create the top tips for sadhana, the top tips for service, and the top tips for attunement. And so on Thursday, especially for those of you who are guests, you'll be participating in some group activities for this. For residents of the community, we're handing out some sheets that you can write that down, and we'll collate it. There's an interesting experiment that's been carried on over and over again. You take a gallon jar and fill it with M&Ms. No, you don't eat that gallon jar. You fill it with the M&Ms, you put it on the desk, and the students in the class estimate how many M&Ms are in that jar. Over and over and over, it's been shown that generally no single person will come as close as the average of the whole group. And so the creation of this list, no single one of us could create a list that will be as good as the group of us together. And so we want you to do two aspects of that. One is the very obvious things. For meditation, it would be like longer and deeper, or withdrawal of energy, or regularity, those things that all of us will think of. Then secondly, we want you to do things that most people won't think of. Maybe it's like, what's really helped me is a good cushion, or get a bangle, or have water by your meditation room, whatever has helped you. So we want the regular ones, and then the little things that have helped. So all of us together are going to create three lists during this week so that we can be participants in these three pillars.
Okay, I'm going to start just by a little show and tell. Sita Bai handed this to me. This is the first hard copy book. Some people have no idea what I'm holding up. Some people are applauding. This is Touch of Joy, A Yogi's Guide to Lasting Happiness. This is, I guess we just got one from the printer. And so this is the new book that Jyotish and I, it's a compilation of our blogs from 2015 and 2016. And it will be available. You can order it tomorrow, Tuesday, February 20th, if you order it. It's really exciting. We have a wonderful team working with Crystal Clarity, and we mentioned this at the minister's retreat. We're trying to get this on the bestseller list. We started out, it was 250,000th in ranking. It's now up to 16th. If we get it in the top 10, it makes it a bestseller. So if all of us order one or more copies on Tuesday directly from Amazon, we can get it up on the bestseller list. So that will be a lot of fun. Sita Bai said, don't give it away. So there it is. Okay. So there's a wonderful article that I recently read from Master, which I highly recommend. It just really kind of blew my mind away. It's in The Divine Romance, and it's called The End of the World. I thought, that sounds interesting and close to home. And Master just, he says in this, you can tell he was in a very exalted state. I mean, when wasn't he? But when he gave the talk, but he said, I am talking to you about things that have yet to come. And he's really, it's a very prophetic talk. And in it, he talks about, he said there are many aspects to the end of the world. First, there's the literal aspect, when the world as we know it is the earth is completely destroyed. He said, don't worry about that. He said, that's a very, very long time away. He said that the earth is a school that God has created in order for all souls to come to God. And then he says, that is my job. And he said, and the world will not be destroyed until that purpose is accomplished. But he said, partial dissolution is another thing. And he said, this has happened many times when the thoughts and activities and behavior of humanity become so negative, so filled with anger and hatred and violence and revenge, that those vibrations go out into the ether and they disturb the electromagnetic field of the earth and everything is thrown off. He said, that's when, and see if you feel any of these things have happened. Diseases are rampant, forest fires occur that can't be controlled, floods, earthquakes. I mean, why are all these things happening? The climate begins to change and weather patterns are different. It's because of the negative energy that mankind is putting out. And so he said these partial dissolutions, Noah's flood. He said that, I mean, we read it in the Old Testament. Why did that happen? It says, because mankind the children of God had become evil. God wiped the slate clean. World wars, why did they happen? Because there's so much negativity. And then he goes on to say, but, if nothing else, Master gives us hope. Always, always hope. And he said, the predominant karma of mankind is good, and we are in an ascending age. So there is hope. But then he goes and talks about the cycles of time. I won't go into it because we all have read and heard about the yugas. But I want to touch a little bit on Dwapara Yuga because I want to talk about sadhana in Dwapara Yuga, how and why. Very immediate. So we know Kali Yuga is the dark materialistic age, 1,200 years. Then we come up and here we are in Dwapara Yuga. When I first, many years ago, heard about the yugas, I thought, oh, we're in a new age. This is great. And then the more I read about this 24-year cycle of Dwapara Yuga, and Master says it in this article, there is no safety in Dwapara Yuga. It's a time of uncertainty, instability, because there isn't spiritual wisdom, science, he said, it's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And all the wonderful technology we have, you know, the great thinkers of our time, Stephen Hawking and the visionaries, Elon Musk and Bill Gates, they're all saying that the greatest threat to humanity is going to be artificial intelligence. And so science is dominant in Kali Yuga, but not with wisdom. And so Master said, thank God Kali Yuga, thank God Dwapara Yuga only lasts 2,400 years. Yes. And again, that's the good news. It's not long. But then just touching lightly Treta Yuga, the age of mental powers, 3,600. And this is what I loved about this is that in Treta Yuga, because people, it's telepathic communication. Won't that be wonderful? We can throw away our cell phones. We won't have to tell people, turn off those things. I just have to say, we were giving a program in Assisi, and people's cell phones, they always go off. And we said, we're not going to tell you to turn off your cell phones, but we have a special device now that if your cell phone goes off, your number is automatically given to an international telemarketer. And you choose. So, but communication is done through mental telepathy. And so you think, well, so what? But the good news is, because you can feel and read other people's minds, truth becomes preeminent. People can't lie. You can see right through it. There's no hypocrisy. There's no fake news because everyone can see what's real. And then Satya Yuga, the age of where everyone predominantly, Master said, even in any age, there, it's not that everyone is that way. He said, even in Satya Yuga, there are people living in the Stone Age mentality, but predominantly. But here we are in Dwapara Yuga. And he also talks about each age being, and this is, Satya Yuga, I should say, is 4,800 years. And then I did a little calculation. I thought, well, this is good news. Kali and Dwapara are only 3,600 years, where Treta and Satya are 8,400 years. That's a good percentage. The good is much better, much longer than the little dark ages. So that's hopeful, too. But in Dwapara Yuga, it says in the Indian scriptures, and this is very interesting, I believe it's the Srimad Bhagavatam, but some of our friends who are more familiar will correct me if I'm wrong. It says that the cow of dharma, of right action, in Kali Yuga stands on one leg. In Dwapara Yuga, two legs. That poor cow is trying to balance on two legs. Not much dharma. In Treta, dharma stands on three legs, and in Satya, the dharma stands firmly established on four legs. So here we are in this very unstable, very unsafe Dwapara Yuga, where dharma is not something that is readily established and does not permeate our society. So what? Here we come to looking, what are the pillars of our path that can uphold dharma in the age in which we live? And it's just what we're talking about. What are those pillars? Our sadhana, our seva, our attunement, and one that we haven't mentioned but runs through everything, an underlying awareness of God in everything. Some few years ago, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, we were visited by, here at the village, by a wonderful saint from, or Swami, from Rishikesh, Swami Shankarananda. He's a Kriya, in the Kriya Yoga line through Sri Yukteswar, a disciple of Sri Yukteswar. And he has a Kriya Yoga ashram in Rishikesh. And we were showing him around the village. And he was, of course, he was very, very inspired by what he saw. And he said, you can't say that Ananda village is like an Indian village. It is like an ancient Vedic village, meaning when God was preeminent in all of the thoughts and all of the activities, every song that's sung, every act of service. And so this is the fourth pillar of our path, living in awareness of God all the time. And that's why Master said environment is stronger than willpower. If you're around other people that think that way, then it's so much easier to think that way. And so how can we, coming back to sadhana now, and as Jyotish said, sadhana is not just meditation. Sadhana is all of the spiritual practices that we do, the techniques, that all of what all the Master has taught us to help us, as Jyotish was saying, dissolve the hold the ego has and to be able to realize that God dwells within us. I want to take a little aside here, because when we talk about becoming a Jivan Mukta or achieving samadhi, what happens? What's our first reaction? The veil comes down. I can't do that. Maybe they can do that, but I can't do that. But you know, there's a wonderful joke, and forgive me my friends who are from Maine, but there are a lot of jokes about Maine farmers from Maine. I guess they have a very down-home, wry sense of humor. And so in this joke, a tourist is lost in a rural area of Maine, and he sees a farmer, and he pulls over, and he said, how do I get to this town? And the farmer stops and goes, well,
You go to the fork up ahead and you take the left road and no, that won't work. No, you go straight till you hit the crossroads and then you make a right turn. He goes, no, that won't work. And then finally he paused and he said, you know, you can't get there from here. And so it is with becoming a Jiva Mukta or Samadhi. When we think about it with our ego, we can't get there from here. There's no way. The ego can't find samadhi. The ego can't become a Jivan Mukta. But there's another part of us, like those spontaneous, calm areas of the ocean, that knows, I am already there. God is with me. And that's the part of us, the true part of us, that will become a Jivan Mukta, that will achieve samadhi, and we'll look back and the little ego will say, what about me? You left me at the crossroads. Well, yeah, we did. We did leave you at the crossroads because I couldn't bring you along. You have to stay and play in the world, but I don't have to do that. And so remember that. Whenever someone presents a spiritual challenge or a high goal, watch your reaction and watch the part of you that says, not me, and say, that's not me. That's the ego. And we can do it. Master said, I came to bring every soul on earth to God. He says it indirectly, but if you read it carefully, that's what he's saying. And so, with the grace of the Guru, this is possible. So, what now? Let's look at the Dharma of our sadhana in Dwapara Yuga. Because once Swamiji was asked, he was asked many times this question, and he gave different answers on different occasions. But on this particular occasion, someone asked him, what is Ananda's mission? And on this occasion, what he said was, Ananda's mission is to equalize the world on the spiritual plane. And so what he was saying was, here in Dwapara Yuga, with the tendencies that we see, restlessness and violence and lack of ability to see a unified whole, all of these aspects of Dwapara Yuga, fractioned, that in this age, our job is to counter that energy. And how are we going to do that? In part through our sadhana, in part through our seva, in part through our attunement that we'll be talking about in the next days. But what is the dharma of our sadhana now, both for ourselves and because we happen to be, if not members of Dwapara Yuga, at least temporary residents here. And so the first thing I'd like to talk about is truth. Because Master said also that the quality of each yuga is a different caste. So Kali Yuga is predominantly the Shudras, the laborers. And Dwapara Yuga is the merchant consciousness. And of course there are dharmic and adharmic merchants. But when we think about the merchant, a little bit devious, self-interested, trying to do things according to their own benefit. So we live in an age where truth is not, it's clouded. It's hard to discern what's true. And so in our meditation, to really work on self-honesty, instead of saying, oh, well, I did pretty well today, if you know that you sat down, you wasted a half hour looking, okay, I'll speak personally, a half hour looking at Facebook, knowing that you're eating up your time for meditation, and then you sit down and say, oh, it's okay, it was okay. No, it's not okay. Be honest, you blew it. And you don't have to condemn yourself. You don't have to say, okay, I quit. Just say, approach your meditation with honesty. Did I really try today? Was I justifying myself? If I did something wrong, and the other person did something right, and I don't like that, am I justifying it? You know, many years ago, someone wrote us a very critical letter, wrote to Jyotish and me a very critical letter saying everything we were doing wrong. And it was right before a big Christmas open house at the Crystal Hermitage with Swami. And we read the letter. It hurt us, but we thought, okay, let's put it away. We're going to go down. We're going to see Swami. We'll leave it go. And, you know, in retrospect, and some of you have heard this story before, but this was an insight that came to me just in thinking about it in the last couple of days. Some of the things they said were right in that letter. I couldn't accept it at the time, but they weren't totally wrong. And so we walked in, and Swami saw us. We just tried to put big smiles on our face. And he looked and he said, "What's wrong?" And we said, "We don't want to ruin the party." He said, "Let's go in the other room and talk." So he just pulled us aside. And we said, "So-and-so wrote us this really critical letter." And he just didn't say much. And we were waiting for him to say, "Oh, that's terrible. Why did, you know, it's all wrong," which he didn't. And we said, "Swami, are these things true that the person wrote?" And he just smiled. He said, "You're doing the best you can for who you are." And then we kind of weren't satisfied with that. So we said, "Well, was that person, those two people, wrong for writing the letter?" And he said, "They're doing the best they can for who they are." And then he looked at me, he looked at us, and he said, "And I'm doing the best I can for who I am." Total self-honest, no justification. And so in your sadhana, approach it with honesty. "Here I am, God. You know my mistakes better than I do." I saw a beautiful article recently called "Loving the Imperfect Child." And it was advice to parents. Don't expect your children, they don't have to be the straight A, the Olympic athletes, the great artists. What if they're dumb and incompetent and rebellious? You love that imperfect child. And because that's what God does to us. He loves the imperfect child. And as long as we keep saying, "Hey, nothing wrong with me," that doesn't help. So honesty, one of the pillars of Dharma in Dwapara Yuga. Another pillar is self-discipline. And we live in an age where anything goes. And to try to say, "I will set aside a time every morning and every evening when I meditate. Nothing will interfere with that." No self-justification. And then we discipline ourselves, not only in our sadhana, but then it pours out into our daily life. Master said in another instance, he said, "Every day I think about what I'm going to accomplish that day, and I don't go to sleep until I do it." A great goal. Discipline your life. And that's built on honesty. "Oh, I didn't have time to do it." What time did you waste that you could have been doing that? Self-honesty and self-discipline. Bring them into meditation. They counter the forces of Dwapara Yuga. And then self-offering. We live in an age of self-interest. Everybody's trying to see how they can get the advantage on the others. If we can stand our ground and say, we just like we did after the forest fire here at Ananda, when to not go into the full story, but 1976, a big fire came and burned down Ananda and all our neighbors. And the cause of the fire was a faulty county piece of equipment that was shooting out sparks. And all of our neighbors sued the county for millions of dollars. We didn't have insurance. We lost everything we had. And they settled out of court for huge settlements. We went to Nevada County officials and said, "We are not here to take, but to give. We are not going to sue you. We will rebuild without insurance, without homes for the winter, with families with no places to live. We are here to give." And if you, in your meditation, if you can have that thought, not, "Oh, I got to have samadhi, oh, I got to have this experience, I have to see the spiritual eye." You just give. Just give. Say, "Master, I love you." And if you never, ever come, it doesn't matter. I'm not going anywhere. I am here to give. I'm here to give everything that I have. So self-offering. And We live in an age of restlessness, concentration. Anything in your meditation, but in anything that you do, you are giving a gift to the world. I know some of us are work in scientific research areas. Remember what Sri Yukteswar said at the Kumbh Mela? He was thinking to himself, surely the scientists in the West, with their concentrated effort to uplift humanity, are doing more good than these sadhus who are just begging, passively receiving. And so concentration in our meditation, in our life, it balances the restlessness of our age. And it's not easy. If you spend a lot of time just looking at the internet, what's going to happen to your consciousness? Restless, restless, restless. That's what this age is. We need to counter it. We need to say, I will hold my ground. I remember when we were with Swamiji in India, when he was writing the Bhagavad Gita commentaries, he set a goal. I mean, there were people coming and going and so many other things going on, but he set a goal to write 10 pages every day of the most profound spiritual wisdom that has come to this planet through Master, those Gita commentaries. And we were there, we were living in this little porch area off his office. And it was thrilling to watch the concentration that he brought to bear, no matter what happened that day. Sometimes he would be, we'd see the light go on in the office at 1 o'clock in the morning, it'd be on till four, then it would be off. And he, every day he said, I did my 10 pages, I got to 20 pages today. And he was able to write that book, 600 pages in 2 months. And it's not light stuff. It's the most profound commentaries, as I said. So the joy of concentrating, and that when you bring that into meditation, if you break through the restlessness, it's like, ah. And from that joy of concentrating comes calmness and inner strength, so that we don't have to be always reacting. Really, this Dwapara Yuga is trying to provoke us to react. And if we just say, I love the affirmations from some of the yoga postures. In stillness, I touch my inner strength. That stillness that comes from concentration, self-offering, everything we've been talking about, this is the dharma of our sadhana in Dwapara Yuga. And this is how we can, Master said, we can rise above the age in which we live, and we can achieve samadhi. And then he ties, in this article, he ties it back, and he said, there are two kinds of samadhi. And I always, when people start talking about that, I always shut down. But this was, I loved it, it was delightful. He said, sabbakalpa samadhi is with condition. That's when you go into a high state of God consciousness, but then you come back to normal consciousness. He said, what is the end of the world? There are two kinds. There's the literal and there's the metaphysical. And in the metaphysical, there are two kinds. There's the partial dissolution, that's sabbakalpa samadhi, and then there's total dissolution, that's nirvikalpa samadhi, when we never return to egoic consciousness. And so this is, we'll stop in a few minutes, and then we'll have a little break, and then we'll meditate. And we brought along with us, we're going to listen to, at our meditation at noon, Swamiji reading Master's poem, Samadhi. But let's hold that. We can do this. We have not come into this earth at this time only for our own upliftment. Master didn't have to come back. But as God's boatman, coming back a trillion times if need be, as long as one stray brother was left weeping by the wayside. We are all those stray brothers and sisters. He came for us, but not, and we need to understand, he came for us, but he also can come through us. And in this age in which we live, in the pillars of the path that he gave us, he gave them to us to help us find God in Dwapara Yuga and to equalize the world at this time in history.